Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
You all know that NetConf is one of those magic words that will bring peace to Earth, solve all the network automation problems, and, you know, make you redundant. We all know that's usually not true, but I don't think that many people know what NetConf is all about. So I was more than delighted when my friend Marcel Wiget from Juniper, Switzerland, sent me an email saying, you know what? You really should talk to the guy that was there from the very beginning. And today he's with us. Welcome, Phil Schaefer, distinguished engineer at Juniper Networks. Did I get this right?
Yes. Thank you.
And with us also, to keep me honest and to ask all the questions that I will forget, are Nick Buraglio. Hi, Nick.
Hello, hello.
And David G., who knows way more than I do about NetConf because he was stupid enough to volunteer to do a NetConf webinar for me and discovered all the beauties of various NetConf implementations that are all supposed to be NetConf compliant and probably are, but each one behaves in a totally different way. You still have scars from that experience, David?
I've got serious mental damage from that whole experience. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so thank you for that. And actually, I volunteered, so I'll blame myself, but it was a hell of an experience.
So let's see how this whole thing started and how it turned into the morass that it is right now. But before that, Phil, what are you doing at Juniper and how did you get to be involved with NetConf?
So I started at Juniper in 1997. I was the UI group. I was the first member of it. And one of my initial strategies was to layer our CLI on top of an API. What I wanted to do was to make it so that the device could be completely controlled via remote applications. The goal was that people would stop signing into routers and stop using CLIs and simply use external databases and tools to generate configuration and download them. So we wanted to make sure that everything in operational mode and configuration mode was completely accessible via applications. So I went in with that design in mind. I actually said that during my interview, and I think that's one of the reasons why I got hired at Juniper. That was because of this strategy. We didn't announce the API until 2000 in the Junos 4.0 timeframe, 4.1 maybe. And then that year, or 2001, I took the idea to the ITF to try and get it standardized. And that work became NetConf. The big push was to get us out of the mode of screen scraping and regular expressions and be able to use tools like XPath or similar technologies to be able to refer to data by name in a way that was not release dependent, that wasn't fragile, that was able to survive the major, your applications able to survive upgrades and future-proof them.
Okay, so let's get this straight. For all of you out there that are reading white papers, how API is the way forward, this idea is 20 years old, right?
Absolutely.
And when everyone is telling you how great the APIs is and how you should stop using CLI and the way forward is by using API, that idea is also 20 years old.
Absolutely. I'm sure it's older than that, but our implementation is that old.
So just to set the record straight.
Absolutely. And in those 20 years, we've had customers in the full range, customers who completely live in the CLI and customers who bought into the API and, you know, literally, for those customers, it's a firing offense to modify configuration on the box. You know, they just don't tolerate it.
Okay, so you already have people who firmly believe in going down this path.
Absolutely.
How soon did that start? When were the first customers hooked onto the idea of using API to configure the box?
Literally within the first year of coming out with it. There are people who see this as valuable from the start.
So in 2001, let's say you already had people who were using API exclusively to configure the Juniper boxes.
Yes.
Yet again, for the white paper readers, keep that in mind. And I know that the Juniper API didn't change that much in all the intervening years, apart from getting new attributes. But what was the path then from your early implementation to NetConf? How does this thing derail into just another wrapper around the text messages?
Well, the hope is that it's not just another wrapper around the text message. Let me talk about the history for a bit. So we went to the ITF with a couple of problems that we wanted to address, and we wanted to address these in a standard. One was the initial API was a document-oriented API. You sent a full document, full XML document, you got back a full XML document. We wanted to change that so that each RPC lived individually. So in that front, so that is part of NetConf. Another bit was framing. The framing that we use, we wanted to be more rigid, and that's finally happened in the latest NetConf. We wanted to solve some of the problems we had with our implementation while making it standard. So the RPCs that were available in the original API, get configuration, load configuration, we actually carry through into NetConf. NetConf defines a set of RPCs that allow you to get data, like edit config and get config. Unfortunately, those are different names than the original Junos API. So we were able to carry our operations into the new protocol. So in some ways, NetConf was a huge step forward in that you could lock configuration. You could programmably retrieve and restore configuration. The parts that it was missing was the content. And so in 2008, we started working on Yang, which is a data modeling language for NetConf. Again, it's based on the work that we did in Juniper. We have what we call DDL, a data definition language. And that allows us to describe fully all of the configuration and commands and the return data for all of Junos. So having that information in Yang allows the client to see what possible parameters for an operation are and what can possibly come back from that operation. And again, it's represented in XML or JSON so that you have specific programmable access to it without having to resort to regular expressions and screen scraping. The base NetConf allowed you to simply take CLI output, wrap it in RPC reply tags, and send it back. We saw that as a vehicle for getting people onto the bus, right? Part of any technology is getting people involved on the bus as it's moving. Once they're there, you can start to improve the implementations and raise the bar. But just getting from the screen scraping world into an RPC-based world, into a data-modeled world, into a standard data model world, this is the escalation that we're trying to push to. And if you look at the activities in the ITF right now, you know, we're getting to that stage where we have hundreds of standard models being developed. It's kind of an exciting time for NetConf Yang.
I guess a thing to call out as well now is with efforts like OpenConfig, you know, there's an effort to kind of standardize some of those where, as we opened the show, we talked about NetConf. You know, NetConf is a standard that isn't standard across, you know, most of the vendor offerings. But obviously with the kind of popularity of structured RPCs, OpenConfig's playing a nice part in driving some of that forward.
Yeah, OpenConfig is an industry consortium where operators got together and started defining data models. Some of those have fed into ITF models, and some of them have stayed independent of the ITF. It's a variety. I think both solutions are worth pursuing.
Coming to some of the details you mentioned in this intro, you decided to use XML as the presentation layer. And today, everyone is talking about JSON. So I guess the reason you chose that was because JSON just wasn't there at that time. It's a newer invention. Or was there something else in XML that made you choose XML?
So with RESTconf, you can do the same operations over JSON or XML. But setting that aside, yeah, in 2001, XML was fairly new. JSON was uninvented at that point. So XML was the obvious choice. I actually like XML for three reasons. XML gives you a hierarchy. You can arrange elements inside each other. It gives you an extension mechanism. You can use namespaces so that if there's a standard called type and I have a Junos configurable called type, they'll be in different namespaces and they won't collide. And the third thing is in encoding XML elements, you have attributes, and attributes allow you to put metadata directly into the data. For example, if you retrieve the Junos configuration, you can get it automatically tagged as far as which elements are keys for data structures. The downside is XML is an SGML, so it has open tags and closed tags, and there's repetition. Most of that compresses away to, you know, 4 or 5% of overhead, but it's still painful. My thing is, you know, people shouldn't have to write XML computers. It's a good interchange between computer programs. I don't like it as a human authored language per se, but it's actually good for interchange. Like I said, namespaces give you future proof so that you avoid collision and stuff like that. JSON's newer, but I wouldn't call it new. It's 2009, 2008, something like that. It has the benefit that it's easy to decode JSON content directly into native types. You know what's an array, you know what's a number, you know what's a Boolean. That sort of meta information about the data is actually encoded in the encoding. You could do something similar with XML, but it would require an attribute to say, this tag is a list item, this tag is a Boolean, this tag is a integer.
Yeah, or they would guess if there is only one tag at a certain position, it must be a hash or a dictionary, whatever language you use. If there are many tags with the same tag name, it must be a list.
Right. That actually makes coding harder. So you can do that kind of assumption in XML, but it actually makes life harder because when it's not true, you have code that expects an array, and instead of getting an array, you get a singleton.
Yeah, I experienced that with a platform that shall remain unnamed. We're going from XML into JSON because that's exactly what I've seen. If there was one value, it would be returned as a dictionary. If there were multiple values, they were returned as a list.
Right. Now if you have the Yang information available, then you have that metadata. And Yang will tell you, you know, this item is a list. This leaf is a key for this data structure. This is an integer. This is a Boolean. All that information is in the Yang, but it's not transmitted with the data. So you have to download and parse the Yang data to be able to have that information.
So to go from XML to JSON, you should always carry your Yang definition with you to know how to do the translation.
That's the downside.
At that point, you know, is it actually, so as someone that was around in the very first implementations of Junos, you know, I learned XML for that and some other projects that I was working on, you know, so my opinion here might be a little bit tainted, but you know, is the human readability that you gain from that, realistically speaking, is that worth the complexity that it adds of having that extra layer in there? And maybe that's something we don't necessarily want to, maybe that's a rabbit trail we don't necessarily want to go down. But that's a question that's been kicking around in my head as I pound on this stuff a little bit now, a little bit more.
Are you talking about the readability of text versus a binary encoding?
Well, no, I'm talking about the, I guess I should wrap some context around that. So that, you know, the reason that I've always heard for, you know, the inclusion of JSON into things, the biggest one is, you know, the human readability factor that it gives you. Comparatively speaking to XML, which I don't necessarily buy, but I've also been looking at XML a ton. Let me preface this by saying I'm not a developer, right? I can kind of munch things around and write proof of concept code, but like no one wants to run the code that I write. Does the JSON give you, what value add does that really give as opposed to just learning the nitty-gritty details of XML? And maybe you've sort of touched on this a little bit with what you've said, but I'd like to explore that a little bit more.
I'm in the same boat you are. I've been doing this for 20 years. I don't see that big a difference, especially because these aren't things that are meant to be read or ingested by your typical user.
Right.
They're meant as an encoding. So I'm not a big fan of closing tags, but they actually do serve a purpose. Let's say in Junos, right, and I'm producing XML and I'm missing a close tag. I can look at that close tag and know exactly who's responsible for having not emitted that close tag. If, on the other hand, I have 27 close braces and I'm needing 28 close braces, I don't get that information about who's at fault. So from a programmer, it's actually nicer in terms of validation and fault finding. You know, that's a small advantage. But again, you know, you'll get a chunk of JSON, you'll call a function to parse it, you'll get a chunk of XML, you'll call a function to parse it. The relative merits are fairly minor. Again, the bit I like about XML is just the extension through namespaces and the metadata through attributes. And you can see there are various schemes, various wrap XML and JSON schemes, and they're pretty bizarre. You know, it's an unnatural act.
I agree with that.
Well, as much as I love XML, and I actually developed websites that were totally XML-based and used XSLT to generate HTML, I tend to hate namespaces because of the complex implementations of the XML parsers. So as long as you're parsing XML without namespaces, life is good. The moment you have to start dealing with namespaces, it becomes interestingly complex. Let's just put it this way.
Yes, it is a very pedantic naming scheme.
Not only that, you have to make sure that every time you search for an element, you include the namespace, and you have to predefine the namespaces in advance, yada, 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 yada. And it looks like namespaces were slapped onto many of the XML parsers out there. So it's always, you know, an extra step to make the namespaces work. Or maybe it's just me.
Yeah, I want to as well that namespaces have caused me lots of headaches in the past where a parser's broken something, so maybe it's not kind of read the namespace correctly. And then it's actually interpolated it and put a different namespace, and thus you've now injected some other, you know, I think there is more surface area to break and screw up. So I'm not a fan of them. I don't even like how the way they, to be honest, they kind of look at them and think, oh, namespace. But I get the merit, you know, the whole thing of avoiding collisions. It does serve a purpose.
Yeah, I'm surprised there aren't more hooks in libraries to do wildcarding for namespaces. You know, if I could say star colon type in like XPath, that would make sense. But they're not there.
Yeah, no, they're not. Exactly. It's not there. And by the way, for the listeners, David is not on a different planet. Like speaking from Mars, he's just in a hotel in Frankfurt. Phil, the other thing that always amazed me, since I know a little bit about Junos, and I know how well you guys started the whole idea with, as you said, you can lock down the config, you can change the whole config, you have the candidate config, and then you can do commit or rollback. And in the end, it all watered down to something very rudimentary, and everything else is optional. And most of the NetConf implementations today don't support the ideas that you had in 1997. So what went wrong?
So again, it was about getting people onto the bus. It was seen as new and radical, and we really just wanted to grease the skids and get people onto this track as quickly as possible. We wanted to make it so that people could take their implementation, move to NetConf as quickly as possible, and then add features once they've supported it. There are two ways to view the world. One is, you know, everything should look exactly the same and be identical, and your manager should be simple, and then your device should do that translation from the ideal into its native technology. Well, that's a good idea. There are a lot of devices that are underpowered or underimplemented and won't be able to match the ideal. In fact, there are places where, you know, if you go back to SNMP days, you find places where boxes have to fake up a MIB variable because if they don't return it, managers die. And if they, so they have to return a fake or a zero value just to keep the world happy. One of the things we wanted to do in NetConf was to be able to say, here's what the box does. Here's exactly what the box does. You know, whether it's a capability that says I support this Yang module or this protocol feature like candidate. We wanted the box to be able to say, here's where I am on the technology curve, and then be able to have the manager, the network manager, meet it at that level. You know, again, the expectation, and I think, you know, especially in the last years, we've seen more of this, is that these implementations will improve and they will become more standard and the world will become a bright and rosy place.
Since you mentioned the dirty word of SNMP, I'm going to go ahead and kick that horse a little bit. Given that SNMP has been around a very long time, and that the implementations, albeit very likely crummy, you know, are fairly prolific. You know, from an implementation standpoint, one of the things that I've heard over and over and over again is I've asked for NetConf because, again, Juniper guy from way back when. And, you know, as we do RFPs for things, you say, well, I'd like to have, you know, this programmatic interface, you know, NetConf or whatever. And the vendors that weren't Juniper would always respond with saying, well, we have SNMP. And I said, well, I need to be able to do configuration changes. Well, yes, we can do SNMP version 3, which anybody who's ever tried to do that wants to, you know, fairly quickly jump off the roof. Do you see SNMP version 3 as something that delayed the expansion of NetConf, or is it orthogonal? Is it just something that happened that wasn't related? I'd like to get your take on that.
My view is SNMP works great for monitoring, but configuration, it was pretty much dead 25 years ago. I mean, it's just never been used. So the folks who came out with V3 thinking it would be used, I think were just tilting windmills. It was never going to happen.
Yeah, I think I'd take that one step further and say it's not even really that great for monitoring, but that's my personal bias.
Oh, wow. Chris will be so disappointed right now.
David, now it's your job to say something nice about SNMP.
I think you're being mean to SNMP. It's provided network engineers, you know, with what, probably 2 decades worth of monitoring. And for the most part, for a business, it serves a purpose. I think it's got a home. I personally, when I go to a NOG, I ask the audience who's doing SNMP right, and I get poked at a lot of the time by Chris Young for this. I think I can count on one hand the amount of organizations, you know, even there where the guy's been sitting there and somebody to his right nudged him in the ribs and said, no, we don't do SNMP rights. We need to do REIT. I think SNMP serves a nice purpose, but this is where NetConf comes along and provides you that kind of structured data interface. Monitoring is interesting, and that raises a whole telemetry argument as well. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. You just got like a million and one thoughts going through my head now, and I'm also trying to play the part of the missing presenter as well.
The SNMP view was kind of a peek and poke, right? You're fetching individual variables. You're at best tracing a subtree. NetConf gives you the ability to fetch the complete configuration for an interface or the complete configuration for a BGP peer. That kind of single cohesive model, I don't want to use the word object, but that single chunk of data that you get back that says, here's all the information about this interface. And it may be in Yang modules that you don't understand, but it's all here.
But isn't that the problem? So in SNMP, everything's there. You just have to know where to go and get it. And obviously with a Yang model, if you have access to the Yang model, which is a whole other argument, if you have access to the Yang model, sure, you can go and find it. And some people are saying, well, what about if I've got a gRPC interface? That gives me static types and it's an encoding type and I can go and get information. I just think it's obviously NetConf is one of those. I think in the networking world, we always say we come along and we do our own thing instead of maybe taking a much more generic view. But I think SNMP and NetConf can, I think, continue to live side by side. But it raises the next question for me for this podcast and for the audience is, if we use SNMP for monitoring and basic kind of telemetry, we go and push things and maybe receive SNMP traps, can we just talk a little bit about NetConf telemetry? So, you know, receiving messages and alerts and monitoring and using NetConf. So we can do SNMP, get. So if you do a get operation, you should get operation information. Can we get a deep dive a little bit more around the telemetry aspect?
So there's a new draft in the NetConf working group for telemetry. And I think it's exciting. In Junos, we do telemetry right off the chip for our embedded interfaces. And that's a very non-SNMP model. You know, you'll come in through NetConf, you'll subscribe to particular bits of information. Those will get filtered down to the hardware, and the hardware will have a UDP port that it's sending data to. And you'll receive that data and it'll be tagged with whatever information you subscribe to. That's a much better model.
And the encoding is still derived from Yang, so you still have that model to build our data structures from. Yep. And also used for validation, which is an important piece. I think sometimes that's gotten Yang providers a nice interlingua to do validation against it as well.
That's, you know, wet paint sort of technology, but it's very promising.
Okay, but if we step back like 10 steps, because you guys went down another interesting rabbit hole. SNMP was used for monitoring, and let's stop mentioning SNMP as much as we did, should make Chris happy. But you can also do monitoring with NetConf, because with NetConf, you, even though it has conf in the name, you can also get the operational data. Now, Phil, what's your impression? How many people are really using NetConf to get real-time operational data from the device instead of, let's say, SNMP?
At this point, I would guess very few. You know, SNMP has such an established position as the monitoring protocol, and you can get it on every device. There's no way you can sell a device without having a SNMP implementation. And I think the new thing is you can't sell a device without NetConf for configuration.
Oh, you'll be surprised.
I think that's coming. I don't really see NetConf displacing SNMP in this area. The telemetry stuff, I think, is probably the only progress in that area.
When you say telemetry, you mean streaming telemetry, right?
Yes.
So just to explain to the 3 people in the audience that haven't heard about it yet, it's the idea that I subscribe to some information and then that information is automatically sent to me by the device without ever asking for it again, right?
Right. Instead of the poll and response and poll and response, you just get this endless stream of data coming off the box. And because it's coming off the embedded hardware, you're getting it in a more timely manner. You're getting more precise. You can get far more data than one can typically carry in SNMP.
So you are generating the data straight in the hardware. It doesn't go through the CPU.
Exactly.
But that means that it cannot go over TCP, right? Because then a CPU would have, well, someone, the TCP stack would have to be involved. And that's why you send it over UDP, right?
Right.
And what's the presentation format for that streaming telemetry? XML, JSON, or binary?
So right now, that's something we're working on. We do GPP for that. Huawei has a fixed format binary, if I remember right. I'm interested in looking at, there's another ITF standard called CBOR that does complex binary object representation. There's already a translation from Yang objects into CBOR encoding. So it'll either be CBOR or gRPC or both. I don't see this sort of telemetry being in XML or JSON.
Yeah, it would be a nightmare to generate a text-based format in hardware.
I was just going to do a sideways question. I thought it was possible to do NetConf monitoring over TCP and stream it over in an open session.
You can come in your normal NetConf session and say, I wanted to monitor these, send me notifications for those, and those go out over your normal NetConf channel.
Then to Ivan's earlier point, the CPU obviously has to step in and obviously kind of multiplex onto a TCP session.
Right. And on most boxes, like Juniper boxes, the path between the PFEs and the routing engine where the NetConf session is handled is rate limited, and you want to be careful about overloading that. So that's the attraction of sending it directly out of the hardware. The volume of data you can get is much greater.
Okay, so now that we mentioned notifications, they are sort of like SNMP traps, right? They are unsolicited messages that network device can send to the manager over the same session over which NetConf is running.
Yes, they're a little different. SNMP traps are pre-configured. So you have to go into your device and configure what you want and who you want it set to. Whereas with NetConf, you come in as a session and you say, these are the things I care about, feed them to me. So it's a much more dynamic setup.
Yeah, and that was one of the arguments I've heard when I said, well, why don't you guys just use the REST API? And it was like, no, we can't do that because notifications. But in reality, how many people are using them in real life?
Now that I couldn't give you a number for. Certainly there are notifications defined for some of the base models, and I know some of the models being standardized have notifications in them.
I've done a lot of looking at, you know, this type of thing over the last, you know, forever, basically. But what I think we're seeing here is, I think we're seeing sort of the birth of a different way to more efficiently monitor certain things, right? Because as we look at the landscape of equipment out there, you know, we see more or less, I agree with you. I think you're not going to be able to sell much that doesn't have a NetConf interface, or at the very least an API for management of some sort. You know, with that, you know, we're also seeing the inclusion of hardware-based telemetry for monitoring, for, you know, analytics at a much more real-time pace. And then also for the standard things that we may have been seeing typically SNMP get used for in the past. What I haven't seen, and I think one of the reasons that we don't talk about this as much, is that I haven't seen any, you know, real progress in the systems that actually consume that data and then do something with it. Whereas with, you know, with other protocols, you've got, you know, a myriad of choices, commercial, open source, whatever, for, you know, consuming traps, for, you know, polling interfaces and stuff like that. I think as more of those things become available to folks that are building networks or that are, you know, making procurements with the plan of using telemetry, or maybe they're just discovering that it exists, I think we'll start to see a shift of those things, because hardware generated data is almost always going to be better than something that's, you know, shoved out of a CPU that's probably undersized for what you're doing.
Yeah. So you've got Juniper applications now that can take that streaming telemetry and do, and I have to hand wave here because this isn't my area, but do very cool magic with it. But it should be a couple of days of programming to get these telemetries into any time series database and to just allow classic analytical tools to have access to that data.
I think once we see, you know, two or three of the, you know, widely deployed open source monitoring systems implement something like this, I think that's what'll give it a foothold to really have people start using it. Right, because there's a lot of those that are already deployed, you know, and you know, say like there's a system that I use called LibreNMS, and it's open source and whatever, and it does SNMP stuff, and it does a pretty good job. But they do a week, you know, actually, I think it's a nightly update, and there's always new cool things getting added to it. If, for example, one of those updates was, you know, hey, now we can consume streaming telemetry, but, you know, from, you know, over NetConf, then people are going to see that and they're going to go, oh, wow, my stuff does NetConf. I'm going to turn that on and see what the difference is. And I think we'll get more and more of that happening over time, is my crystal ball prediction.
Absolutely. You need stuff on the other side to devour that data and tell you what's going on in your network and what you should be doing.
Right on cue. Come the next thought to this. I'm seeing a strategic shift away from NMS as data collectors and data ingesters to time series databases, or kind of, you know, data lake kind of approach, ingest massive amounts of data, have almost live queries, one in which posts have been sent off to an NMS or even metadata updates. And I think, especially when you now have telemetry coming off the hardware and sent out in datagrams, I think we're seeing now the network as a big data problem, as well as now, you know, traditional. More applications. It's becoming more of an application type problem as well as...
I get what you're saying there. I mean, the network generates a monumental amount of data. And what do you do with that data? You don't really want to delete historical data because you may need it later on. Or maybe you only want to keep, you know, for compliance reasons, you only want to keep like 2 weeks of data. But how do you store that when, you know, the rate that it's being generated is increasing exponentially over time? You know, disk gets cheaper, but how do you query it? You know, these are big data problems that I'm thinking about all the time. So this is an interesting problem, although I think we've sort of digressed away from NetConf.
Yeah, a little. The interesting thing is the data ingestion, the data storage is kind of mirrored. If you look at classic systems, and we said we're not going to talk about SNMP anymore, but if you go and receive SNMP information from a query, we store it separately, either in an RRD or in some counter or some variable somewhere. But when we start taking enormous amounts of data in, we tend to throw it into a big pool and say, right, you're there, I know where you are, I'll go and get you if we need it.
So before we leave that, I think these new time series databases are really the solution there. And so it's nice to have somebody already working on an answer to your problem, even though they don't realize it's your problem.
It's always great.
By the way, Nick, I can tell you the answer to the question, what happens if you enable NetConf notifications on some of the boxes? They crash.
Man, don't tell me that.
Okay, sorry. Didn't want to hit a raw nerve.
No, it's fine. You know me, I'm always looking for a way to not use SNMP.
Anyway, Phil, half an hour ago you mentioned RESTConf. What is it and what's its relationship to NetConf? And why is everyone talking about that like it will save the world now that NetConf maybe won't?
So RESTConf is a parallel protocol. It allows you to do REST-ish, RESTful things over HTTP and to be able to get to the data that way. There is a large section of programmers who understand how REST works and understand JSON. And, you know, those are their two hammers. And if your problem doesn't match their two hammers, they have little interest in it. So we want to appeal to those programmers to make it so that you can easily plug into the frameworks that they choose. You can easily get access to NetConf data over these alternative protocols. It's the same information presented in a different protocol.
I was about to say RESTConf and NetConf being parallel protocols. So the ACID, the whole, you know, premise of ACID still applies to RESTConf. So the whole atomicity, consistency, isolation and durability. So if I was going to go and post a single transaction, and maybe if I was doing it via the CLI, the operations would have to be in order. But the thing I understand from atomicity is I can bundle that together in maybe even an out of order set of operations. So maybe a policy map with some statements and a prefix list or whatever. And that applies to RESTConf as well as NetConf.
Absolutely. NetConf exposes the lock. So you lock your configuration, you do your edit configuration, you do your commit configuration, then you do your unlock. Those as distinct operations. Oh, I'm sorry. This is assuming a Juno style candidate, which is an option. You can take a lock, do a edit config directly on running. You won't have a commit, and then you'll do the unlock. But setting that aside, let's stay in my world where you have the candidate. In NetConf, you could do a lock. You could do several edits and then a commit and then an unlock. In RESTConf, each operation is atomic. So if you ship three different changes inside one RESTConf payload, they'll be committed under the covers. The same thing will happen. It'll do the lock, it'll do the three edits, it'll do the commit, and it'll do the unlock.
So let's say one of the atomic pushes fails. In the ideal world and with the right implementation, what should happen?
I think that's a parameter to the operation, but you should be able to fall back to your previous configuration, or you should be able to ignore it and move forward.
So you never end up in a position where you got like 75% of the configuration is taken and the 25% that's failed hasn't.
Right. You really want to be an all or nothing sort of thing. Again, I think there's an option to allow you to ignore problems and continue forward. But I think that's kind of like running with scissors. You really don't want to do that. You really want to say, if something's wrong, someone needs to handle it. Don't presume to turn my box into a brick.
David, that's how Junos works.
Oh, yeah. It was a loaded question.
You don't want to know how some other platforms work.
Yeah, for sure. I'm talking from pain here. I'm so burnt with all this stuff. It's.
So I think we should take one quick step back. And for those people that may not know, we sort of dove right into like how RestConf works and that kind of thing. But, you know, folks that may not be, you know, may not have a development background, you know, may want to know like, okay, what is this thing, right? So it's basically, you know, just to give it a quick definition, RestConf is just an HTTP-based protocol that, you know, utilizes Yang models. And correct me if I'm wrong here, guys. It utilizes Yang models and the data stores that NetConf provides to allow people to do configurations in a similar fashion, right? It's just another interface into configuring things from outside the box.
Yeah, the only thing that I would correct, and it's really touchy language, is a Yang model is essentially a set of constraints. You know, if you look at an XML document, you can put anything you want in any organization inside an XML document. Same with JSON, you can put anything there. Yang gives you the rules and the constraints that that data has to provide by. When I'm talking NetConf to a device and retrieving data from it, it's not that I'm retrieving the Yang model per se, it's both of the participants, the client application and the server device, both understand the rules of the data that's modeled in the Yang model. So if I say, you know, every user needs a password and you ship me a user without a password, we both know that's wrong. It's not that you have to wait until commit time to figure out that that's wrong. The constraints are in the data model. So you're not actually shipping Yang data back and forth. You're shipping data encoded in JSON or XML that abides by the rules of the Yang modules that the device supports.
Okay, good clarification. When I was sort of learning these things a while ago, you know, when I do searches for, you know, NetConf, actually more RestConf because I knew what NetConf was. When I do searches for that, they were always coupled together, right? So it was always NetConf Yang, RestConf. They're very, you know, intertwined in my aspiration for learning those things. So I thought it was important that we maybe call out sort of how that's different.
That is a really good question. It was on my list as well, by the way, Nick. That was a really good chat. I happen to deal a lot with NetConf, maybe not as much as Phil, but I mean, almost on a daily basis, I'm talking NetConf and Yang. And you go and see whether it's customers or even just contacts and you talk about Yang and it's so misunderstood. You know, people actually think you get like a Yang data structure back and you kind of end up pulling your hair out and crying to yourself in a corner.
Yep, I've been there.
Really, really messy.
Yeah. Trying to call it a constraint language, I think, is the best thing that helps people model it in their head. A good example is language, right? You and I can make a bunch of syllables back and forth, but it's really the language that allows us to mean something. And the rules of that language, the noun, verb, adjective, you know, the parts of that language and the organization and the syntax of that language is essentially what Yang is describing.
I always like the word interlingua. It's like that middle thing. We can, you know, use it to translate between different things. And I kind of love Yang for the whole validation piece. Sometimes I get a little bit disappointed with a lack of tooling in the mainstream community to help with that. And I think there's more slowly coming out, but some of the tools are also quite expensive. And not only that, some of the Yang models, some of the tools out there require dependencies. And if you don't have the dependencies on the tool, it will tell you that some of their models validated when it actually hasn't. And in production, we see that a lot. Not necessarily from the vendor I work for, but we see it a lot when something goes wrong. You're thinking, well, that's interesting. My tool's validated the model, but the data is not being ingested properly. And you kind of wonder why. And there's lots of misconception and misunderstanding. So even developers sometimes screw it up and get it wrong in the field.
It's a quickly evolving field. So the ability of implementations to catch up, to keep up with the ideas and to keep up with the drafts is also key.
Yeah, it's definitely confusing. I mean, when I was learning some of the stuff, you know, when we were doing a bunch of open flow work with SDN controllers and things like that, it was all JSON at that point. So I thought, I'll just learn this and, you know, that'll be fine. And I don't need to do anything else for a while. But then, you know, that quickly went sideways. And then it was, learning the RESTConf and the Yang models and things like that. I think it gets confusing to people. So it's nice to have that, have us sort of call those things out as, here's what you do with this and here's what you do with that.
Yeah, there's one other thing that I want to clarify. Phil, you mentioned, if I understood correctly, that with RESTConf, each single request is atomic, but that's it. There is no transaction spanning multiple requests.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
So in NetConf, I would open a session and then I would say, change this and change that and change that. And oh, by the way, change that. And the requests are accumulating on the device side, assuming the device has candidate config. And then I'm saying commit and it's implemented. Whereas in RESTConf, you have to batch everything into one single request on your end, right?
Yes. NetConf kind of gives you more flexibility. RESTConf gives you more simplicity. It's that trade-off.
So RESTConf has no idea of a long-living session like NetConf does if it's running, for example, on SSH.
Right, because it's following the REST model where every transaction is, every HTTP operation is its own independent transaction. And you can tear down the connection and bring it back up, or you can do one operation per connection. It's the typical REST model.
So it's the classic /HTTP stuff. Why do they call it RESTConf then?
So it's NetConf operations over REST.
Ah, okay. Makes sense. And the encoding is JSON or XML?
You could use either. It's a query parameter to choose your encoding.
And finally, we were talking about notifications. And if you're using NetConf over, let's say, SSH, you're getting notifications in the same SSH session. How does that work with RESTConf?
I'm not a RESTConf guy, but I believe they come back as HTTP notifications.
Okay, so for anyone who's interested, go and read the draft.
Yeah.
I was about to say, I smell a blog post in the works.
Okay. Challenge accepted.
I mean, the drafts are actually fairly easy to read.
Maybe just a compliment out of all of the NetConf implementations I've ever played with. And now I think just for the exercise we did for IP space, I spent days and days and days exercising loads of them. Juniper is probably the best one. And I think it's probably the closest one to the spec as well. So yeah, I think good job Juniper on that front.
Well, thank you. And
good job to Phil. So that's my take on that. So thank you.
And send me email about anything that's not out of the spec. If it's not already fixed, we'll get it fixed.
Lovely stuff. Thank you.
Now that you mentioned that, Phil, if people want to know more about NetConf or RESTConf or how things should work or how things actually work, apart from the webinar that David did for IP Space, where else can they find information about NetConf, let's say?
So there's a website called yangcentral.org that has a bunch of tutorials and additional information about it. The ITF has all the drafts. I think those are fairly easy to read if you skip the first couple of pages of IETF overhead. There are videos out on YouTube from Juniper and other competitors that step you through it. I think that's about it.
And if people want to get in touch with you, are you somewhere on, this social landscape? Are you on Twitter? Are you blogging? Is there something else where you're publishing what you do?
Well, I'm Phil at juniper.net. Email's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me. I'm on Twitter as PhilATJuniper. I've done blogging on the Juniper forum site.
So thanks, Phil, for this intro to NetConf. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, David and Nick, for asking all the interesting questions. If people want to find you online, how can they do that?
So I'm available. This is Nick. I'm available on Twitter at Boralio. I also blog at forwardingplane.net on occasion.
On the rare occasion, yes.
Yeah.
And you, David?
You can find me on Twitter at VTEP42. I've not changed my username in quite a while, so I'm probably due for a new one. And I also blog at ipengineer.net and occasionally on Software Gone Wild with you as an occasional podcast host.
And I'm Ivan Pepelnyak. You've been listening to Software Gone Wild, and you can find me at ipspace.net. or follow me on Twitter, where I usually just publish link to my blog posts.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.